Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Our newspaper panel has been working away this morning. I'll introduce you to them shortly. But first, as always, let's have a quick look at what is making the headlines this morning. Taoiseach Simon Harris was busy before Christmas, as not one but three of today's newspapers lead with stories based on interviews with the Fine Gael leader. We'll ban nameless internet trolls, that's the main story for the Irish Mail on Sunday, which reports that the government will use Ireland's presidency of the European Union in the latter half of next year to block anonymous keyboard warriors from spreading hate and disinformation online. Mr Harris told the Mail that the government will lead calls for the introduction of ID verified social media accounts, along with plans to introduce an Australian-style social media ban for minors. This is not about crimes against my family, said Mr Harris, days after a woman was given a six-month sentence for sending vile social media messages to the Fine Gael leader. He insists it's about global democracy. Harris signals tax cut return after backlash over budget. That's the lead story for the Sunday Independent, which reports that tax cuts for workers will be back on the table for the next 4 years if public finances remain stable. Mr Harris told the Independent's Conall Thomas that he wants earners who work hard to find less of their money gobbled up by the taxman. The Taoiseach also forms the lead for the Business Post in a wide-ranging article or interview with the Post policy editor, Daniel Murray. Mr Harris described the economy as robust going into 2026 but warned of fiscal vulnerabilities. The newspaper notes that state spending has trebled in the last 15 years. The Sunday Times has a different lead. It goes on an interview with by Patrick O'Donoghue. It's with Ireland's most senior Catholic leader, who has warned against the seizure of assets from religious orders to fund redress schemes for survivors of historical abuse. Archbishop Eamon Martin, Primate of All Ireland, cautioned against the state pursuing a policy of targeting the resources of congregations who fail to pay compensation for people abused while under the care of religious-run institutions. Archbishop Martin, who's also the Archbishop of Armagh, said that while religious orders should contribute to redress schemes, this should be done insofar as it is just. He also wants Ireland to regain its soul and for the Catholic Church to take a more prominent role in society. He insists that it's at a crossroads rather than a crisis, despite a critical lack of vocations. The Sunday Times also has an interesting, if concerning, off-lead. Russian submarines tracked on spying missions in the Irish Sea. That's the headline for a piece by investigations editor John Mooney, which says that Russian submarines are secretly being deployed alongside Moscow's best known spy ship to map critical undersea infrastructure around Ireland and Britain, raising fears of sabotage. What I Do for One More Minute, that's the headline accompanying the splash in the Sunday World, where Patrick O'Connell reports on a social media post by Shannon Farrell, who's the mother of four-year-old Tadhg Farrell, who died in an arson attack along with his grandaunt Mary Holt earlier this month. "My heart is broke, my one and only son. What I would do for even one more minute with you," Ms Farrell wrote on a TikTok post on Christmas Eve as Gardaí launched a fresh public appeal for help from the public in tracking down those responsible for the murders. The Sunday World also covers the temporary release from prison of convicted murderer Charlotte Mulhall, who's set to be fully released next year after serving a life sentence. Her sister Linda Mulhall, who was convicted of the manslaughter of their mother's former partner, Swally Noor, 20 years ago, has already been released from prison. And Mulhall's temporary release is also the lead story for the Irish Sunday Mirror, which notes that 137 inmates were approved for festive leave this year. Across the Irish Sea, it's a mixed bag for this morning's papers in the UK. The Observer leads with a striking front page image of a woman carrying a Christmas tree in war-torn Ukraine as its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, meets his American counterpart, Donald Trump, who is pressing Kyiv to give up the last part of the Donbas in a proposed land for peace deal. Mr Zelensky arrived in Florida last night as Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed to take all of the Donbas region one way or another. Well, to discuss this and more, I have in studio with me Niamh Horrigan, sociologist and vice president of academic affairs at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick, Harry McGee, political correspondent for the Irish Times, Tanya Ward, chief executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, and Cormac Lucy, economics columnist for the Sunday Times. You're all very, very welcome. I don't know what the protocol is. Is it too late to say Happy Christmas, too early for Happy New Year? So
Happy Betwixtmas.
Happy Betwixtmas. We'll stick with that for now. I might start with you, Harry. No less than three newspapers featured. Was this the kind of interview that you get in the bag before Christmas and then you've got your post-Christmas splash?
Yeah, so there used to be a kind of a practice where
the great and the good of the state, the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach, and perhaps the Minister for Finance or the leader of the Green Party when they were in coalition, would do what was called a roundtable interview. So all of the correspondents would huddle into a room like sheep being herded into a pen, and each would be given one or two questions to ask of the leaders, and then the stories would be kind of meted out over the Christmas to keep people going through the lean and thin days of Christmas in terms of the news cycle. But that didn't happen this year. So what did happen is that these many ministers gave interviews. And as we've seen today, they gave interviews to different outlets on different themes. I think they probably tried to give them different lines. But of course, when you have one minister giving an interview to three different outlets, you're going to find lines that on the face of it seem to be contradictory. So with Daniel Murray of the Business Post, the Minister for Finance, and the Taoiseach Simon Harris, is talking about fiscal discipline going forward, that we're going to stay within a 6% spending increase every year. Now, I do recall that in recent years, the spending increase was meant to be confined to 5%. And the government was very consistent in that it broke that 5% each and every single year. I think the average was about a 9% increase in spending in each of those years. Now, there were extenuating circumstances. There was COVID and the pandemic, and then there was the energy crisis afterwards. But he also signalled in that interview that the era of once-off spending is now firmly in the rear view mirror. But then you go over to the Sunday Indo, and his interview with Conal Thomas, in which he talks about tax cuts, which to my mind, Cormac might be able to elucidate us further. Does sound a bit more like spending, but he does say that there will be tax cuts in future budgets for hard working families.
No reference to what time they go, Cormac Lucy, to work, but for hard workers.
Well, I'm very concerned about this. I mean, who's standing up and representing lazy workers or people who take it easy? I think this instrumentalisation of interviews, it's part of a kind of a decay of politics. There was a top Irish professor who sadly died very early called Peter Mayer, and he wrote a book called Ruling the Void. And he said the new politics is seen by many citizens as too remote and bureaucratized, too addicted to bargaining and compromise. And instead of giving us tax cuts, we're getting this endless talk that tax cuts are on the way. And it's thin gruel for voters in reality. And I think it
surely what's more worrying, though, is that it's not a coherent narrative. If on one hand you're saying I'm cutting tax for workers, however hardworking they may be, on the other hand you're saying we're into an era of more prudent fiscal spending, you're giving
we have headlines
like
and we cannot see
that actually doesn't make any sense. And I suppose in an era where we're moving into a period where the prevailing economic winds internationally are very precarious, we are in a particularly precarious position because of our exposure to US multinationals, and our dependence on our corporate tax take in 2026 is estimated to be $34 billion. That's a lot of money to lose. In that, what would be much more comforting in this is to have a coherent narrative of, look, the headwinds are very precarious here. This is how we're going to deal with it. This is robbing Peter to pay Paul, and it reassures no one in an era. And I think this is, for me, Dervla, the fundamental issue. We've lost Pascal Donoghue out of cabinet, who's the only serious international player that we had in cabinet, and he played in the financial space, he's a particularly significant loss. We need to see the establishment of a new coherent narrative coming out of the Department of Finance.
But it was a post,
heading into 2026.
It was a post that Simon Harris actively sought.
Yes, and I mean, I wouldn't, you know, he's entitled to seek it, and it's a post of immense influence. But to be fair to Pascal Donoghue, and I would by no means agree with everything he said, he was fairly consistent in his messaging once he came into that post. And that consistency is what you look for when you're steering the economy.
My issue, if you take the two promises, so one, tax cuts on one side, and then we're going to be very tight, there's going to be no departmental overruns. So that means he potentially could have a cut in public services. And the tax cuts for people are often never meaningful enough to make a difference to them and their take-home pay. But we know when we invest in public services, we just get better outcomes. And we know there's massive issues, pressures on the education system, pressures on the health system, pressures on the child protection and welfare system. And that's where I'd hope to see the money go in the next budget.
We were talking about the vulnerability to the international You know, I mean, it's so vulnerable at the moment. And I do remember when the Troika were here, one of the tenets that they had was that the tax base needed to be broadened. It was a very narrow tax base at the time. And in the interview with Daniel Murray, which is a very interesting one, the point is made that €9 out of every €10 that's raised in taxes in Ireland comes from three groups only, and that's corporate, income and VAT. And all of them are really, really vulnerable to the winds of international change. And I can distinctly remember the Troika trying to broaden to tax base, to tax wealth, to tax property, to tax other things rather than immediate income and transactional value. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened if we still have nine out of every €10 coming from those three cohorts of tax.
Cormac, I know you've been writing recently about that kind of relationship and you know, obviously it was a low tax environment that got the economy going in very many respects years ago. But are we high tax, do you think, relative to others? Look, I mean, this, what many of the papers seem to be pointing out is that this sort of hint or suggestion of tax cuts is because of the backlash against the budget.
We are high tax compared to others. We have moved significantly in that direction over the last 15 years. I would be very slow to eulogise Pascal Donohoe. The Fiscal Advisory Council has said that on a structural basis, if you exclude windfall tax receipts from the American multinationals, we're running a very significant deficit at a time when the economy...
And that's a strong course because it's IFAC.
But he was coherent, Cormac, in his messaging. I mean, I know he's coherent in disagreeing with IFAC, to be fair. I mean, I can't think of a single budget where the government has lined up with IFAC since 2015, 2016.
He read books and he sort of tickled the erogenous zones of the Irish Times reading classes. But, you know, if we look at the fundamentals of the state budgets... The state does not account for the pension liabilities it is building up in respect to me as a PRSI contributor and others as public servants. And if you adjusted the public figures for that, we would be running a huge deficit. And if Simon Harris was serious about limiting government spending growth, he would unilaterally change how we account for that and show the real figures. But we and other countries in Western Europe are just drifting into a massive crisis at some point in the next two decades when those chickens are going to come home to roost.
And I don't know if I can call upon you, Harry, to defend the erogenous zones of the readers of the Irish Times, but certainly one of the... Certainly there's a lot of qualification in the papers, including from Simon Harris, if the public finances remain robust. And there, you know, when you look particularly at the editorials, everyone is calling out, you know, just this over-dependence on a certain category.
I mean, in his defence, he's not a wet week in the job. So he hasn't been proven as a Minister for Finance yet. And if he is going to give tax cuts next year, perhaps he's going to find the resources to pay for that from some other area, whether it's either a cut in spending or whether some other kind of income raising measure that he'll introduce to give him his due. But there have been, I mean, I would agree with Cormac to a certain extent in that Pascal Donohoe has been very consistent in terms of the message. But in terms of the practice, it hasn't always lived up to the sentiments that have been expressed. And going back to this firm commitment that the government gave, or successive governments gave, that they would limit spending increases to 5% each year. And they broke it each and every year. And the average was 9%. That is unsustainable.
Yeah. But Niamh, are we sort of partly responsible? Like, when you look at, you know, all of the sort of, you know, the surveys and everything done in advance of budgets, like, I mean, the public want, you know, they see those big sums and they want spending. And they
I think part of the challenge and the reason why there's this kind of incoherent messaging is that even though we've had a government which has increased spending, particularly because of the failure to enact, I think, particularly around housing, very policies that have delivered and have gained traction, because they haven't. The role of housing in driving people into poverty and in driving people who would in other cases be trundling along kind of, you know, on relatively low incomes, that has not been addressed. So therefore, you have a government which has actually been spending quite a lot of money, spending money on social welfare transfers, spending money on public services. But because of this very really intense role of housing and pushing people into poverty, they haven't actually got the bang for their buck. And I think that's a massive problem for them heading into 2026.
The other side of that, though, is they have done an awful lot. And if you look at the statistics, so let's say there's 5.9% of children in the deepest form of poverty, consistent poverty. The SRI has done a piece of work that if they hadn't invested in hot school meals, free school books and those kind of initiatives, it would be 13.9%. Yeah. So we still see these, you know, these nearly intractable figures, but actually that government spending in the right smart way has actually made a difference. I mean, the thing I'm looking for, I suppose, with Simon Harris in this role, and obviously the interviews are a response to the criticism of him taking the brief. I see Daily Mail saying, I think it's wrong. I think he made the right decision of taking the brief. Is he's trying to demonstrate that he's actually going to be a bit like Pascal. You know, he's going to say the right thing. He's going to exercise a fiscal restraint. He's telling the government departments if they have overruns, he's going to hold them back. Now, often the reason they have overruns or the HSE has overruns because in the initial discussions, finance hasn't accepted what they actually need, and they agree mini budgets during the year to actually fund
rather than
the base of the department.
That's
it exactly. But the other thing that would be interesting about Simon taking this role is what's his relationship going to be like with the Fianna Fáil ministers? Because they all have really challenging briefs to deliver on. Norma Foley needs to raise money for early years and TUSA, the Child Protection Agency. Education needs to raise a lot of money for, there's been a growth in numbers of children accessing education. And, you know, healthcare spending is still really significant. How will Simon manage those relationships and those expectations?
And Cormac Lucy, how does the government overall manage expectations? Because we see these headline figures about the economy, you know, being so good, and then, you know, and people have those expectations then and demands that it will be spent, whether it's in the form of spending or tax cuts. I mean, how do we reconcile that sort of that?
With enormous difficulty. I think one of the big issues, you know, coming back to housing, is that I'm not sure people understand how dramatic Ireland's population growth has been over the last 30 years. Yeah. It's been just over 50%, and that's more than double the next closest European state. And you couple that then with sort of constipation in building new houses, and you get a housing crisis, you get people pushed into poverty. So I think they're huge issues, and I think they further challenge government to take charge of things and direct. Mm. And my big concern is that government ministers have become institutional airbags to protect the permanent state. And the ministers come and go, the permanent state remains. But who's driving the permanent state? And essentially it's self-driven. We've things like last year when Dara O'Brien was still housing minister, an 800-page piece of legislation, Planning and Local Government Act. You know, how is that going to fix our housing problem? I think that just
surely part of the I think part of the issue for the government, particularly for Fine Gael, it has to be said, is that effectively they've been in government now since 2011. So their capacity, and again, this is particularly evident, you know, the capacity to develop a new plan and say, we're going to, with housing for all, for everyone, forever, rebuild Ireland. That's just not credible anymore. And it has ceased to be credible. I mean, the last housing plan, all that did was remove targets, which was a legitimate way of calling the government to account. So I think that's part of the issue, particularly for Simon Harris, because he has been one of those politicians who's been in since 2011. So therefore, the capacity to bring that kind of new energy narrative to it is extremely limited.
There's a kind of a dishonesty from political parties, and maybe the media are conspirators in that, in terms of what they promised. Before the general election last year, all of the parties, and I don't think there was any exception, promised that they could deliver 300,000 houses within the term of a government. I mean, once they uttered that, everybody knew that it's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. We're not going to be anywhere near 300,000. You know, to do that, the logistics, the money, the planning, the workers, the labour, the accommodation for labour, you know, the exacting standards that we have. It's not like the 1930s when Herbert Sim designed houses and they built new suburbs over the whole of Dublin. We're not comparing. We cannot compare the houses that were built a century ago with the houses, the requirements that are there now. In addition, they talked about €200 per month for childcare costs. I would be very surprised if that is achieved within the term of government. And then we talk about our climate change targets, 50%, 51% by 2030 compared to 2018. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that's not going to be that's going to happen. If we reach half of that, we'll be lucky. And I think the politicians and the media need to be a little bit more honest in terms of setting out, you know, what is possible, what is feasible and what is not.
But I think, to be fair, Harry, there's a difference on housing, because we had the Housing Commission report, which basically said this approach is not working. You need to pivot to a different approach. This is the approach that will work. And if you do it, it will be delivered eventually. And they just haven't done that. They've stuck with the same old hack. And that's the difference, I suppose, compared to other, and one could argue infrastructure is a massive issue as well, but I think the failure to pivot towards what the Housing Commission was recommending is
a big problem. Each of the solutions is problematic. I mean, the Labour solution of a state housing agency, that would take a long time to set up. It would a long time take to populate with people who were employed, a long time to budget. It wouldn't be it wouldn't be possible within the 5-year time frame. Nor would I argue was the Sinn Féin one. And I know the Housing Commission did make the recommendations, but none of the parties took on what the Housing Commission recommended 100%.
But I think that's still there as a template, and it's very useful. Yeah.
And Niamh, I think you spotted from the macro to the micro a really interesting case. I think Maeve Sheehan was reporting on it in the Sunday Independent about what seemed to be sort of the politest squatters, young students.
These are students squatting in, I think, some part of North Circular Road, exactly. And it went to the High Court. And I suppose it is symptomatic of a crisis. I mean, obviously, as a registrar in higher education, I'm dealing with this every day. Both my children are actually in college, but one of them has a friend in Galway who is actually paying people who are living in a house, and she was driving to Galway, parking her car in their drive and sleeping in her car, and she was paying to use the drive. Now, like, so the crisis in student accommodation, and I know we have loads of families in emergency accommodation, and I'm by no means pulling out students, but it's the one that I'm dealing with. It's hardly surprising that I think it's primarily a Dublin phenomenon. But the other issue is that the most kind of off-sited solution now is the rent-a-room scheme. But the rent-a-room scheme is the Wild West. It is completely unregulated.
Why is that?
You will have landlords or people who will say they can't use the fridge, they can't boil the kettle. Yeah. They have to take every single bit of their stuff away at 5 o'clock on Friday evening because they're renting the room out for Airbnb at the weekend. And these are very, very vulnerable kids. These are 18-year-olds in many cases. Yeah. And if you think about the 18-year-olds in your life, the challenges of navigating that, where they have no rights, it's not an adequate solution to what is a very pronounced problem.
Harry McGee, can I ask you just a line to that, to young people? One of the interesting pieces with respect to Simon Harris, as one of his many interviews this morning, was that sort of notion of implementing an Australian-style ban on social media and having ID verification for social media use. That is not going to enhance our relationship with Donald Trump's administration if we try and pursue that.
No, and so, I mean, Patrick O'Donovan has floated this over recent weeks. He wants to implement a kind of an Australian-type ban, and it does seem to be working relatively well in Australia. But the difficulty for us here in Ireland is that we can't do things unilaterally anymore. So any measures that are proposed by the government, including Simon Harris essentially wants trolls to be named as well. I think that will be difficult given the sway of the Americans and the resistance of social media.
The Digital Services Act, EU-wide, would have to be changed. Yeah.
Yes, that's the problem. So anything that's suggested by Ireland will have to get buy-in from all of the other EU states, the 27 EU states, and it will include a change of legislation, namely the Digital Services Act. And there is resistance to any change from a number of countries or states within the EU. And unsurprisingly, they're the ones that tend to be very much Trump favoured. People like or countries like Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and of course, Hungary. Austria as well, actually, who do not want to see any changes in the Act. Yeah. And that's the difficulty that's confronting the Irish authorities at present.
Saying that, I think still it's politically popular. And I think people would like to see this because of the level of hate and disinformation online, you know, that you'd have to be named, your account would be linked to your profile. But there is an issue from a human rights point of view, because while there is huge levels of disinformation and hate is really affecting politics and democracy, you could end up in a situation where people would be afraid to actually criticise governments. And that would be the issue, particularly in other countries, particularly around the Eastern European countries and Hungary. They're already terrified to criticise governments because of the defunding and the action that they're taking, that's taken place.
Are parents agitating for it, though, Tanya? Look, I mean, you know, obviously with such a big alliance, with the Children's Rights Alliance, is it something that's coming through as a child protection issue?
Well, I mean, he's talking about two different issues. So one is around, let's say, everyone would have their identity connected to their profile. And so if they are, because what's going on at the minute is, and this is where X is really just all fake. Someone posts something and then they use their other accounts then to comment on it, basically. So what you're really seeing is the same individual with 10 accounts trying to manipulate what's in the public domain. So a lot of people have left X and other platforms. You see celebrities doing the same thing as well. But I suppose the other issue is, okay, let's ban children from social media accounts. Why are we doing that? We're doing that because we're admitting we failed. We failed to make the internet a safe place for children and young people. They can still land on any content, high levels of, you know, harmful content, violent sexual content. There's also huge levels of exposure to hate, is what young people are saying. Violence online as well. It's hugely disturbing when children are consulted on that. I suppose one of the solutions is age verification, so you don't get onto some of these websites. I think that is going to be very important. That should come through under Commission Lamont. It'd be interesting to see that. But banning children outright up to the age of 16, there's questions around that, because a lot of young people, they do communicate with each other online. They learn online. They do a lot of that online. And they say it's like a cliff. So you hit 16 and you haven't developed the social skills earlier on, and suddenly you're 16 and you're overexposed and you don't know how to conduct yourself online. So it's tricky territory. But when I hear bans of young people from the online world, that I'm reading that is, yes, because we failed to make it safer for them.
Who will prevail, Cormac Lucy, before I go to a break, the US or Europe on this?
I'd say
existential
US,
battle?
Because I just think we're at risk of conflating a taste question. Mm. Is it good for young children to have early access to social media, and a public order question? Is their access to those things at that age going to risk acts of violence or increased crime? And the data on violence and crime suggests not. And therefore, Europe's heart may not be as much in this game as America's.
OK, well, listen, it's just coming up to 11:30, so we'll take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. With me are Cormac Lucy, economics columnist for the Sunday Times, Tanya Ward, chief executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, Harry McGee, political correspondent for the Irish Times, and Niamh Horrigan, professor or vice president of academic affairs at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. Harry, when I read the off lead in the Sunday Times this morning, Russian submarines tracked on spying missions in the Irish Sea, it sort of like, sounded like a Bond movie plot.
Len Dayton novel, Cold War espionage and what have you. And that's essentially what's happening. We're seeing a kind of a reprise of the Cold War in some form. But this time, Ireland and the UK seem to be targeted. So John Mooney is reporting on an incident that happened in 2024 involving a spy ship called the Yantar. And the new information that came to light is that it was accompanied by a submarine, which seemed to have been taking a survey of some of the undersea infrastructure that connects Ireland with the UK,
which can be easily mined, as we
saw. And they're looking at it as they're basically the contention in the article is that they were looking at them as basic targets in the future for sabotage or for some kind of destruction. And
it's an issue, Harry McGee, I think that we will be looking to, particularly in the context of the forthcoming EU presidency. I think your colleague Ellen Coyne this morning was reporting on the likely cost of that presidency, a significant part of which is for security.
So there has been concern because, given the prevailing climate and the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, and acts, extraterritorial acts that have been created, that have been perpetrated by Russia in the past year in several EU states, including Denmark, and more recently in Ireland, when Volodymyr Zelensky was coming in, there were drones seen 10 miles off the eastern coast of Ireland. It has heightened concern in relation to the state of our security, especially in advance of an EU presidency. And we're going to have a presidency next year when there will be countless meetings. Head of every one of the EU 27 will be coming to Ireland at various stages, and there will also be a meeting involving them all, and it does raise security concern and the state of Irish security. So Ellen put in a query in relation to the cost of the presidency in the latter 6 months of 2026. I think the overall figure is €300 million, close to €300 million, 293, but 125 million of that will be earmarked for security, mostly to the Garda Síochána, but also to other state agencies, to ensure that the skies and the seas and the all the areas around where the events are taking place are secure. And that is really actuated by, you know, rising concern about putative threats that are posed by Russia. And Antonio Costa, who's the head of the EU Council, was in Dublin last month, and he was asked about that, and he said he was reassured that Ireland would have sufficient security to ensure that all of the presidency happened in a safe environment. But I think there are concerns that we probably don't have the wherewithal and might have to resort to support from other EU states, particularly from the UK. And then it does raise questions.
The UK
isn't part of Europe anymore.
It's something that we've always been, I think, living with, you know, is that the Russians have always circled these waters, particularly of because of our location with the UK. And one of the things in the article that points out that the UK arsenal is in Barrow, which is the northwest of England. So you come into the Irish Sea to get access to it. And what is notable, because, you know, Russians were always at this, but they are now, you know, a European aggressor. So we're back in this Cold War territory, and they are investing hugely in a submarine fleet, and they seem to be very interested in the nuclear fleet, the UK
fleet.
But
I suppose the challenge really is that when we were in that Cold War period first time around, the UK were part of the EEC as it was then. And we did lean on them for defence and security. There's no question about that. And now they're not in the frame. Now, obviously, they have their own concerns about Russia because they've been very vocal supporters of Ukraine.
And they're our closest neighbours.
They also still provide backup, essentially, in the event of anything happening above in the air.
Yeah.
So anything that concerns overflight or an attack or aviation, I think we do have informal understanding, probably a formal understanding with the UK
for backup. It's very sophisticated there. What the UK have, actually, because they've built that up since the Second World War. But the thing, reading the article, I thought, you know what, we have to be energy independent. We have to focus on, we can't be reliant on gas lines coming from the UK if this is, because one of the suggestions is that they could lie explosives, and in a time of war, they could blow them.
The other issue is that Micheál Martin and
Cormac Lucy.
What I find quite astonishing about this debate is that when we had the Troubles going on in the north, people constantly called for peace. And all of the responses on this topic have been kind of war porn and this threat is coming in, we need to have a military response. We are a militarily neutral country. It is not in Russia's interests that we would follow Sweden and Finland from being a neutral country into full NATO membership. And in my opinion, the first thing that we should do is speak diplomatically to Russia and make that clear. And emphasise a peaceful, you know, I do think we need to beef up our own defence forces.
Right. You're absolutely right. We should speak the language of peace and diplomacy. The problem is Putin. Putin doesn't listen, and he does. He breaks every agreement and every rule. So it does concern me that Europe is arming and putting all this money in, because what they're doing is when they're arming up, they're taking it away from
but
public
services. But Europe has broken treaties. Like the Ukraine gave up nuclear weapons. And in return, they got supposedly cast iron security guarantees from America, among other powers. And they haven't come through. So we're in a mixed up world.
But I suppose, Cormac, to be fair, if you look at the comparator in terms of neutrality, it would often be Austria. And like Austria would be regarded, compared to ourselves, to have a much more credible neutrality because they have taken responsibility for their own security in a way that we have not. Micheál Martin launched a national security strategy in 2019 and nothing has happened since. So part of the problem in terms of chairing something like the European Council for 6 months is that massive security responsibility is coming into a vacuum situation where we have no coherent national strategy as to how we manage our security within a context of the neutrality that we are currently agreed to. And I think that's really where the issue is, and the kind of informal reliances, and I know, you know, with the UK in particular post Brexit, that's simply not realistic now as we go forward, and there's no question that the EU is a particular is particularly vulnerable and a particular target if you look at the narratives coming from East and West, and as a kind of given where we are located geographically in terms of the EU, we need to start putting that security challenge into a coherent strategy.
Can I ask you, Cormac, Mark Galeotti has a great piece in the Sunday Times this morning. For all the posturing, in the end it comes down to Donetsk, and kind of one of the points he makes is that exhaustion on all sides may be the deciding factor. And obviously there are crucial meeting today in Florida between Zelensky and Trump, and this kind of land for peace deal. Will diplomacy win the day?
Well, either the Russians will win the military arm wrestle, or there will be a diplomatic solution. And my worry is, if I put myself in Vladimir Putin's shoes, if I make a peace, the first thing that will follow the peace, just as like the Fianna Fáil presidential campaign, will be an inquiry. You know, so if I'm Putin and I concede peace, suddenly there will be an opportunity in Russia to say, well, should we have had the war? Was the war fought properly? Did we expend too much on to gain too little? So Putin has an interest in keeping this going and also in letting Zelensky keep on making negotiating concessions that Putin just quietly pockets without making counter concessions. Yeah. So my fear is this stalemate will continue to Russia's slight advantage indefinitely until Russia secures a win because the West gives up backing Ukraine.
Harry, there's quite a lot of pieces this morning, including by Katrina Perry, I think, in the Sunday Independent, on Donald Trump's first year, which seems to have been as consequential as his the entire 4 years of his first term. And kind of interesting seeing the role that he is playing in terms of his international record is actually, well, I don't know if he's trying to use it at times to dwarf the domestic one.
Yeah. And Katrina has a page, and she could have had five pages or more. It just keeps on going. We talk about the rolling news cycle, but now we have a new phenomenon called the rolling news conference cycle, where he gives a news conference a day and changes the agenda every day and sometimes several times a day. So any criticisms that's directed of him, he can deflect by coming out with a new, even more outrageous line. And it was kind of breathless. I was reading it, and every single line there was something new, something, all the extraordinary things that have happened within the States in the past year, and as you correctly pointed out, Derville, internationally. And it's been extraordinary.
Venezuela,
for example,
Nigeria.
Talking about, you know.
But also, Trump thrives on this, you know, constantly flip the narrative, constantly create
masterful.
New.
He's a masterful manipulator. Of people in the media.
But there has been change. There has been real change as well. So he's talking about the vaccines, about the rollback on childhood vaccine advice, which is happening in the here and now. She's also talking about walking through Washington. And she said there are soldiers standing on street corners and walking the footpaths of Washington, D.C. and other cities, notwithstanding many legal challenges. And then she's also talking about an administration, as I said, which has a permanent eye on the news cycle. So it's kind of chaotic.
But out
of that chaos, you're also seeing fundamental change. And there has been a very, very big change in the way that US society has ordered itself.
The biggest level.
In terms of its domestic and international outlook.
Of any president since the wartime president. Mm. Actually, when you look, New York Times went through all his promises and what he's managed to do, particularly in the area of immigration. He has the lowest levels of cross-border crossings. And precisely because of ICE's policy of detain now and ask later, you risk, as a legal migrant, being sent off to a country that you've never been before. But alongside that, he's failed in many areas, particularly, you know, when it comes to job losses in the industry, 50,000 job losses.
And the numbers are coherent. And I mean, that's the thing. If you look at the approval ratings, that's what's starting to come out now as the most coherent piece, despite all the flipping in the latter part of 2025, where the numbers are consistently going down. And we are starting to see Republicans now, particularly the younger ones, windy about the midterms. The Epstein vote was a particular important moment in terms of unity across the spectrum. So, I mean, despite...
When you lose Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Despite Trump's chaos and this whole question of affordability that Mandani landed, that is a consistent
question. And can I ask you about that, Cormac Lucy, because you've been keeping an eye sort of on the potential canaries in the coal mine and otherwise in the US economy. Like, I mean, despite all the tariffs and despite all of the shake-up, look, I mean, this year saw, I think, the largest number of corporate bankruptcies in the UK or in the US this year, and some of them in areas that he says to he's caring about, like manufacturing. You know, so there's there are different. It's really that affordability issue, despite all of the bombast, that is that kind of the potentially fatal threat to his presidency.
I think what we're seeing in the American economy right now is an arm wrestle between the old economy, where all of the indicators, if you look at the unemployment rate that's been climbing quite steadily in the last 18 months, those types of indicators are strongly indicating that the US is about to go into recession, may already be in one, versus the boom in
the stock
investment
market
in AI, the rise in share prices that is pushing, the increase in people's wealth that then encourages them to spend more. So you have these two countering forces. And I think in the next 6 months, we're probably going to see the old economy gradually outweigh the AI effect.
But
and,
so
and,
many
and see
Trump
recession.
Voters were of that old economy and voted for him because he made, I mean, if you look at the red states and the farming red states in particular, they've been hit because of tariffs. They've been hit because
soybeans.
Of cuts in food aid. Yeah. You're seeing huge numbers of farmers go bankrupt at the moment and they've lost their migrant workforces.
Yeah.
And these are hardcore red states which continue to vote for Trump. So, I mean, it's his voter base. I mean, the question is, are there enough AI tech billionaires and millionaires to keep him in office?
Well, one of the economic effects that we don't get much coverage of here on this side of the Atlantic, you know, Tanya pointed out to record low immigration levels. There have also been record high rates of increase in blue collar wages. And you know, it's not all good or all bad. There are good bits mixed with bad bits.
It was 3% growth in the last month in the US, which surprised many economic commentators. And also the effect of tariffs. I mean, some people have protected the tariffs would be a doomsday scenario for the US,
but
it hasn't been. It's been far
been
more
hit,
modest
yes,
than was predicted.
But I think because a lot of the companies are absorbing the costs, and when that runs out and they have to hand it all to consumers.
Sure, they might be delaying the inevitable, of course.
Can I ask you, Harry McGee, about Patrick is it Donoghue in the Sunday Times carries a really interesting interview with Ireland's most senior prelate, Archbishop Eamon Martin. And whilst the headline focused on this row over redress, there was also a couple of very, very interesting themes that he set out on.
Yeah, and I mean, I focused on the news. I thought the newsline was quite interesting, and it's tricky, you know. I mean, a church saying that we shouldn't be paying as much as we should be in the face of terrible abuse of children over many decades is a very, very hard argument to make. So his argument, as and I'll just set out what he said. He said that there was a bit of political opportunism, in his view, being demonstrated at the moment. And he said that, you know, that any suggestion that the state would seize the assets of the religious orders was unjust. He said that they shouldn't be compelling religious orders and dioceses to pay recompense for historical instances of abuse that was disproportionate to their responsibility. So essentially, he was calling for a balancing between the responsibility that's carried by those institutions
and
also by the state. Yeah. But against that, Patrick O'Donoghue was talking about 2,395 allegations of abuse that are currently being dealt with against 42 religious orders and 300 schools. So we're talking about a lot of historical abuse. But his argument, and this is the best quote from the news piece that Patrick O'Donoghue wrote, was, "I would hope we're not back in the penal times where the church will be unjustly targeted with regard to assets." He said the state needed to be careful that responsibility was justly apportioned. So it was a relatively controversial view in relation to that.
I was a bit surprised because I would have expected, you know, accepting a responsibility for what happened in the schools and in the institutions. I mean, one of the reasons why we have such a very clear sense of what actually happened to children was because the amazing records that the church has kept, because they were being paid to provide these services and provide education. And, you know, the church is sitting on a massive land bank and huge levels of resources and investments. And that was proven by Rita Riley, did a piece of work for Primetime where she showed that the Christian Brothers is actually sitting on huge levels of wealth. But I suppose one of the things, if you look back, what has happened before is the church has guaranteed they would contribute to the bill. This is in 2002, around the residential institutions. In fact, they only contributed 16%, which is why, obviously, the state now is dealing with a massive issue when it comes to education. And they potentially might be looking to seize assets because the church has shown itself not to hand over the assets. What I would hope is that the church takes a different view in relation to this and sees the damage that was done to the victims and says, look, we're going to join with you and we're going to find a way to pay for the remedies and the abuse that took place for those young people.
Cormac, you also said that we need to rediscover our soul. And I thought it was interesting saying that despite, you know, this lack of vocations, the fall in numbers of people attending churches, he's saying that he views them as a crossroads rather than a crisis, and that it needs to take its place once more. The Catholic Church needs to take its place once more. And
well, in my youth, I was part of a comedy group called that didn't go very far, called Peg Sayers, the Motion Picture, and we put on an event at the Project Arts Centre called God Aid. Let's make religion work. But I've actually started going.
Did it
back.
Do well?
It converted a number of souls, but it didn't go beyond that. But like. I do think he's right to say, Eamon Martin is right to say, Ireland should regain its soul. And I do think we've made massive advances in material terms. But we've record levels of loneliness. You can't walk down the street, but you're at risk of bumping into somebody with their head down into a mobile device. I do think there's a lot of unhappiness coupled with this fantastic material advance. And wealth doesn't fix all problems, and aligning what you're doing with your life with your deepest sense of what's right for your life is important, whether that is carried out through Christianity or just doing the right things.
And I thought it was interesting, Eve, because he appeared to be drawing a line, or perhaps hoping to draw a line, under the controversies of the past and saying, you know, we need, as the church, to find our voice again, and we need to be able to talk about issues and values. Do you think enough time has passed?
No, I don't. And I don't think it's possible to draw that line at this point. And to be honest, I don't think it will ever be possible to draw that line. I don't think it's appropriate to draw that line. I think memory is really important, and I think that piece of memory will always live, and it will always have to be part of how the Catholic Church navigates both public spaces and more local spaces going forward.
And yet, Harry McGee, religion remains an important thing for many, many people. I know it has fallen, but I think at the last census, we were still looking at close to 70%, so 69% of people for whom their faith, the Catholic Church, is important.
Yeah, I don't think people practice very much anymore, and there's a big generational divide. I mean, if you go to Mass any Sunday, you'll see that most of the people would be grey topped rather than well, they might be grey topped, but they originally they might have been grey topped, but there is a generational divide. I think people will identify as Catholic. I think for some it's culturally Catholic as much as religiously Catholic. They do like to observe the rituals of weddings, baptism, and funerals, and they're still an important part of people's lives. And I mean, it is. I mean, most people in my generation were brought up with the Catholic Church, and no matter how much you distance yourself from it, there's a little bit like the original sin that Niamh was talking about. There is a part of it that never leaves you and persistently stays there. But I agree very much that you can't really forget or start at square one after all that's happened. I think that always has to be present. But I do think that the church probably does need to kind of move on and kind of focus on the values that it should be espousing and advocating in society.
The most strategic thing, and when I look at my everyday work, and we have a lot of faith-based members in the Children's Rights Alliance, and some of the best work I see are from the faith-based organisations like Crosscare and St Vincent de Paul. That kind of social change work, addressing poverty and inequality in society, it makes a huge difference. And that's where those faith-led church bodies, they make the biggest difference in Irish society. So if I was the Archbishop, that's where I'd be looking.
And maybe the Catholic Church should focus on regaining its soul. And as Tanya says, turn back to the original core message of faith and individual observance, rather than try and run a parallel state.
You might get to review that comedy show yet. We'll take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. With me are Niamh Horrigan, Harry McGee, Tanya Ward and Cormac Lucy. Cormac, there's a very, very powerful piece by Philip Nolan in the Irish Mail on Sunday about a life-changing stroke that he had. I think he was on duty covering the election of the Pope when that happened. But you had your own experience this year.
I did. About 10 weeks ago, I had a stroke on a Saturday morning. Lying in bed, reading, about 9 in the morning, I suddenly felt dizzy. I got out of bed and I stumbled. I'm 65. I thought, oh, these things happen. And I got up and got showered and dressed and went out to go shopping. And I fell over in Super Value in Black Rock. So I have a younger sister who's a GP, and I rang her and she said, get into A&E immediately.
But you got a bus.
I got a bus, yeah. I made a mistake there.
I don't know if that is the best of advice. It goes against the FAST protocol for it. But like, you know, Nora Ephron, I think it was, who said, you know, that the late, great Nora Ephron said, you know, everything is copy. And so it is proved, because you were able to get a column or two out of it, because you got a pretty unique insight into the health service.
Well, you know about it and you feel passionately about it. So there are two good starting points to write.
Yeah. And what was your sense of it? Like, I mean, you got to see, from what I read, you got to see the best about the health service, but with some frustrations at other aspects of it.
I'd be worried about the management of the health services, that the whole is worth less than some of the parts, that in many ways the management is careless in the sense that things are being done that just don't actually make logical sense. So there's, you know, there are posters up all over Vincent's about mutual respect. But the subtext of the poster, it's all about respect for staff. There's nothing about respect for patients that could be recognised, for example, by patients being seen within 60 minutes of an appointment, by all staff wearing name badges indicating what they do, by elderly patients in particular when they're getting their diagnoses, not just getting them orally, which they may forget, but getting them on a little card with, you know, you've got this, these are the implications, this is the treatment, this is the prognosis. And then they would be better able to share that with their loved ones. And finally, like, if we turn to a dark side of the health services, which would be the case of Aoife Johnston in the University of Limerick Hospital three Christmases ago, when Judge Frank Clark did a formal report on that, there were no fewer than three conflicts of evidence among professional staff. So that really raises fundamental
questions.
Yeah, and I
know questions. That the investigations and are still underway. I want to get, if I have time, to get all of you about resolutions. But first, Tanya Ward, it would not be Christmas unless it was a bit of a familial tension. Anna, you spotted one, I think, in the Times: bridesmaids and Beckhams, but no parents of the groom.
That's it. This is there's good coverage on the wedding of Adam Peaty and Holly Ramsey, and everyone
Gordon
knows
Ramsay's
Gordon
daughter.
Ramsay's daughter.
Yeah.
That's right. Everyone, he's in everyone's household, and it's a bit of colour for the papers, because we get to see lovely wedding dresses and red bridesmaid dresses, and Victoria Brecken in a lovely green dress of her own making. But what's interesting here, and it's probably a familiar enough story for some weddings, is that the mother of the groom wasn't invited to the proceedings, and it seems actually it stemmed from she hadn't been invited to the engagement party or the hen party either. So you wonder what actually happened to get disinvited. But she's actually spoken out into the media. And kind of, you know, this is not the thing you'd want to hear your mother-in-law say. I hope you never suffer the depth of pain you put your mother through. And despite all, she loves you still. Shame on you both. Remember, this is your happiest day. And on each anniversary of your happiest day, the hurt you caused your mum is deeply in her soul, screams.
Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without a little bit of tension. Harry McGee, are you a person who does resolutions?
I used to have long lists of resolutions, but I'm now too old and gnarly too. So my simple one is the old Irish, at this stage of my career, the old Irish one, Gamermuj Bjora Namsho Rish, that I'll be alive and kicking by the time 2026 goes into 2027.
Listen, that is perfect. I'm afraid that is all we have time for. You can listen back to all of the conversations from today's show on the RTE radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Niamh, Harry, Tanya and Cormac joining me.